Welcome to ITE 1, Semester 2, Module 16, Part 2.
Okay, we're talking about a layered security policy. So, it's basically the same thing that we were talking about in the last section. We want a layered approach to security, hardware, software. This might be quite expensive, so you need to make sure that the cost of the security system actually matches up to the value of your data. Grandma's computer probably doesn't need a hardware firewall with a crazy intrusion detection system and everything for her famous knitting patterns.
That was an interesting story, actually, very quickly. We had this guy, this really old bloke, and one of my computer-savvy friends was told to call this, 80-year-old guy up. Because apparently this guy was interested in computers, and this guy was sort of dreading the phone call, and the guy sort of answered the phone, and Bart's sort of like, "Oh, I hear you're interested in Linux." And he's like, "Oh, yes, I used to work on the mainframes back in the 60s where we'd hand key it in through the front panel within assembler. Do I have to do that sort of thing under Linux?" And Bart's like, "No, you'll actually be fine. You just install it and it goes." So, yeah, generally I'd agree with Grace, but you do get some pretty talented old people sometimes.
Oh, not that they're not talented. I'm just talking about a little home computer with very little on it. You know. So, we're going to talk about settings for security software. There are lots of things that you have to set up. You've got to set up security for files, folders, firewalls, wireless devices, and your clients need to be set up or they won't be able to access anything on your network. We're going to talk about folder level and file level permissions. We talked a little bit about this in the Module 12. You configure these permissions to limit individual or group user access to specific data. Both FAT32 and NTFS allow folder sharing and folder level permissions for users with network access. That is not file permissions, because that is an NTFS thing. The additional security of file level permissions is provided with NTFS, which is basically what I said. When configuring network share permissions for a computer that has NTFS, you must create a network share and assign shared permissions to users or groups. I think you guys get to do some of this in one of the labs. Only users and groups with both NTFS permissions and shared permissions can access a network share. But you can actually set these in one go under the sharing tab, I believe. So I don't really quite understand. There isn't usually a time where you're going to set both of these permissions separately, is there, Kay?
Yes. Oh, my word, yes. There's actually a whole... I could do an hour lecture on how you do this, but I'll give you the really short version. Basically, what happens is the file system level permissions always override the network permissions. Okay, and you must know this. In fact, if ever you get into NT server administration and heavy duty, Windows XP 7 sort of stuff, this is the stuff you'll have nightmares about. So your file level permissions override your network level permissions. So what you do is you set the file level permissions to take care of what's going on the actual workstation, and you set the lockdown rules on the local workstation. You then set the network level permissions to actually restrict the access over the network. So say, for example, you might want anybody on the local workstation to be able to print to a printer, but you might only want the admin group to be able to print to that printer over the network, and that's what the network permissions are to do, to lock down the specific network resources. So you go from most specific on your file permissions to least specific on your network level permissions, but the network level permissions are used to limit and control access to shared resources. Wow.
Fair enough.
Anyone here use Cackles? Anyone here?
I had somebody talk me through it once because I was playing with NTFS 3G on my Mac and I totally couldn't get to a whole bunch of stuff I'd copied over. This was before they had fixed this. And so I had to have someone help me do that because I had no idea what I was doing.
That's the one. Cackles is one of those utilities that you hope you never have to use, but to take ownerships of huge trees of files and stuff, it's the only sane way, and it's how you do it in login scripts and things. So, not stuff we touch on in this course, but occasionally if you get like a removable hard drive from someone else and all the ownerships and permissions are set wrong, you can actually use Cackles to fix it, whereas the GUI will sort of have a problem and not let you see things, whereas Cackles will actually recurse through and fix that. So, yeah, heavy stuff.
And for a moment, Grace, your computer was not very well unkeying, but it seems to have sorted itself now.
Okay.
Cool.
I know what its problem was.
C-A-C-L-S, isn't it, Terry?
Yeah, C-A-C-L-S, and there's a free version called X-C-A-C-L-S, which can do other things. Because what they don't actually tell you in this notes is that as well as having permissions, which I think the note sort of touches on, there's also a whole lot of things called access control lists that work on top of the permissions. But luckily for you guys, we don't talk about any of that.
Okay, so we were talking about that these can be granted to individuals or groups. If an individual or group is denied permission to a network share, this denial overrides any other permissions given. So that means if you ever deny anything, access to anything, that's going to take precedence over anything else.
Okay, now before you concentrate on that too much, go and Google up the golden rules of NTFS file permissions, and that all will make sense. So Grace is correct. Deny does override everything, but full control then has precedence over the other permissions beyond deny. So there's a whole lot of nifty rules you need to know.
There's an example here. If you deny someone permission to a network share and the user cannot access that share, even if the user is the administrator or part of the administrator's group. Securing a network includes the proper selection... Oh, absolutely. And configuration of several different technologies. Some of these are... we're going to talk about actually used to configure wireless security. The type of security needed by the network will indicate which security technologies must be enabled and configured in each network device. Remember that all router configurations that you're ever going to see basically in the very basic Cisco courses are based on Linksys technologies, and these are based on the WRT300N wireless router. So if you're going to buy a router and you want to play with things that are in this textbook, you might want something of the Linksys variety, and they're not bad routers, so there you go.
Yeah, they're pretty good.
All right. Wireless
and
antennas.
And they're so common that a lot of people know how to work on them.
Basically,
there's a lot
yeah.
of documentation out there, whereas if you get some of the other ones, it might be harder to find information on how to fix things.
Not that hard. It's a Google away.
It can be harder, though. I mean, if you've got a router that's uncommon and the manual is some image scans of a horribly tilted PDF, you know, manual that came off like hideously printed paper, it can be quite a challenge. And I have seen some really bad router manuals in the past that were not readable. There's also the ones that refresh their web interface every 15 seconds. They tend to upset people a lot. And then if you turn off the auto-refresh page, the JavaScript breaks and you can't change the settings because it's not expecting what you've actually got in your virtual buffer to be actually in place. So they're the really
bad
ones.
One more thing. I know somebody was telling me that they had a router where they could, like, all of the sub-pages were accessible, but the main page that had all the different here's what you can do wasn't, so he actually had to go and make a folder and bookmark each of those individual sections. I don't know if that was an ISP-supplied horror or not, I can't remember.
It really is actually a challenge, because some of these routers are really inaccessible, and it's not until it's sitting on your desk
one
way or the other.
One of the D-Links, at least at one point, you had to actually solve a CAPTCHA to get in and do anything.
Oh, that would have been popular. Not?
Yeah. Even sighted people were not happy about that.
Okay. I'm going to talk about wireless antennae. The gain and signal patterns of the antenna connected to a wireless access point can influence where the signal can be received. So if your antenna is pointing right back at the wall, chances are that you're not going to get the wireless signal very far. Avoid transmitting signals outside of the network area by installing an antenna with a pattern that serves your network users. So you don't need a huge, big antenna that gives Wi-Fi to half the block. I mean, unless you're going to be using Wi-Fi up at your bus stop, which could be kind of cool.
Quick question. Can anybody tell me what DBI means?
What was
Say
it?
Say again, Kerry.
DBI, Delta Bravo India?
Well, I know it's got something to do with the signal strength, but that's about it.
Okay. It's not in your notes, but you will come across it a lot when you're looking at antenna specifications. DBI stands for DB isotropic, which is an isotropic radiator is an antenna that sends its signal in all directions simultaneously. So the signal pattern can be assumed to be read at a specific level no matter which direction you are from an antenna. So what a lot of people don't realize is you can actually get antennas that only send a signal through 180 degrees of their actual field. So say, for example, you've got a house and you've got it over against one wall. You may only want to send the signal back one direction in the house, and you actually get more signal by not sending it in every direction. You actually get more signal by focusing it. So that's why you might want a sector antenna or something. But we don't cover a lot of that. It's something you'd need to do your research on if you were going to purchase.
Okay, network device permissions. Many wireless devices built by specific manufacturers have the same default username and password for accessing the wireless configuration. You should probably change this, or people can easily log in and change it for you and make sure that you can't access your wireless device anymore until you reset it. When you first connect to the network device, change the default username and password. Some devices allow you to change both the usernames and the passwords, while other ones just allow you to change the password. To change the default password on a Linksys router, you go to Administration, Management, and type the new router password. Re-enter it to confirm and save the settings. All right. Quick review of wireless security modes. Most wireless access points support several different security modes. The most common ones are wireless equivalent privacy. Anyone know what it stands for?
Hang on, well, hang on, you just said...
No, or sorry, anyone know what the acronym is?
WEP.
That would be WEP.
That's right, WEP. WEP. This encryption, this encryption, the broadcast data between the wireless access point and the client uses 64-bit or 128-bit encryption keys. We've got Wi-Fi protected access, WPA. This is an improved version of WEP. It was created as a temporary solution until 802.11i became ratified. Now that 802.11i has been ratified, WPA2 has been released. It covers the entire 802.11i standard. WPA uses much stronger encryption than WEP encryption. And then we've got WPA2, Wi-Fi Protected Access 2, which is an improved version of WPA. It supports robust encryption, which provides government-grade security. It can be enabled with password authentication, personal, or server authentication, enterprise. And you'll need a Radius server for that if you're going to go the enterprise route.
One of the things I like about WPA is that if you use a pre-shared key, WPA2, PSK, or whatever, you can make the password wherever you want. So you could make the password, you know, anything that anybody can remember. You know, if you want to make the password, this is my really great wireless connection, that's what your people will type in to log in.
Actually,
so it's a lot easier to remember than hex.
the password must be at least 10 letters long, otherwise there's insufficient entropy to key the encryption algorithm. You can't just set your password to bang, because it's too short, and a lot of the interfaces will go, you don't have enough characters. No, Windows blanks it out. If you try to put in a pre-shared key, they're like, you need at least 10 letters or whatever. It won't actually let you...
I think mine is 9 and it goes.
Okay. Are you WPA or WPA2?
It's a combination of both. Mine has WPA2 personal / WPA personal.
Okay. I know the Windows 0 conf utility will block you out if you have less than 10 characters. It says no. If you're actually setting the password.
I haven't run into any problems, and I think at least one person on this network is using 0 conf. So anyway, a lot easier to remember than hex, though, I can tell you.
Oh, absolutely. And the problem is with WEP is that there were at least two common keying algorithms in existence. So there were actually two different sets of keys that could be generated from the same passphrase in WEP. So just because you put in a password in WEP didn't mean it was going to generate the same four keys. So, yeah, you had to watch out for that. Hex was the only portable way of doing it across all operating systems and platforms.
All right, and the last one we don't want to forget. Don't ever forget about it because it'll be in all of your tests. Lightweight, extensible authentication protocol, or LEAP, also called Protocol LEAP, or also called EAP. Cisco. This is a wireless security protocol created by Cisco to address the weaknesses in WEP and WPA. To add wireless security in a Linksys router, use this path: wireless, wireless security, select a security mode, select an encryption type, and type the pre-shared key, set key renewal, and then save your settings and continue. And the SSID, the wireless access point will broadcast your SSID by default so that wireless devices can find it. You can disable this broadcast on your network to prevent wireless access points from being discoverable easily. To disable SSID broadcasting, use the following path: wireless, basic, wireless settings, select disabled for SSID broadcast, save settings, continue.
This is a bad idea, because if you ever forget what your wireless network name is, and all of the machines that did know what the SSID were, it can be a devil to find your wireless network, because it doesn't show up anywhere. And in fact, I had a situation where I went out to somebody's house and they made me a nice lunch and all these sorts of things for me to fix their wireless network, because none of their machines could see the wireless network. And it turned out that the name of the wireless network was actually Netgear, but the ESSID was hidden, so you couldn't find it from any of the machines. So that was a fun job. The other thing I would warn people too is if you go into a wireless access point and turn on encryption, be aware that once you save the settings and restart the wireless access point, you are going to have to go in and put your encryption keys into your computer if you are configuring it wirelessly, because it will have changed the settings on the connection and you will need to authenticate or you won't connect back to the internet again. So be very careful keying in those wireless passwords and things, and watch that caps lock. Or if you're using an iThing, watch that key dragging.
This is why it's a good idea. This is why it's a good idea if you're configuring the router itself. It's best to do it with a computer that's wired straight into the router through Ethernet if you're actually making these changes. And actually, you can set it so that you can actually set it, and I've considered doing this, so that the only way that the router can be reconfigured is if the computer is attached straight to it. You can actually make it so that wireless devices cannot go into the configuration interface.
The other thing you do not do, unless you've got a death wish for your router, is you do not upgrade the firmware over a wireless link, because if you get a dropout during that firmware upgrade, you've essentially got a brick, and you need to basically get JTAG cables and all sorts of nastiness and a soldering iron to turn your brick back into something useful, if that is even possible with your router.
I certainly, when I flashed mine, I definitely did it with the computer that's plugged straight in. Actually, both of my desktops are wired straight in.
And I bet you sat around for like 2 minutes longer than you actually needed to make sure that it really was finished rebooting, as like I gave you the story of, you know, dire failure. I'll just leave that another 3 minutes because, hey, if I leave it the 3 minutes, I've got the better chance of it coming up.
Absolutely.
That's what I did. I listened to the AM radio to settle down, and then I waited a couple more minutes.
Anyone know what happens if you turn the power off in the middle of a flash? Anybody ever done it?
Oh, brick your router, pretty good.
No, have you done it?
I've never actually done it, but I've seen people who've done it, and the lights do funny things, and the router never boots up.
Ow.
What does the soldering iron do? What do you use that for afterwards?
You can get a cable and try and manually put firmware back on it, I guess.
Yeah, there's a cable that wires up to your parallel port. And I stress the word parallel port, so you'd better have one of some description, because the JTAG interface uses the parallel port. And then you actually solder this thing onto the header of the board, and then plug this 10-pin header on, and then run a cable out to the parallel port, and then force upload the flash into it. Not for the faint of heart.
I think at that point, if it were me, I'd just buy another one and throw the other one into the recycling.
Sometimes it can be worth getting them fixed, especially if you want to run Tomato or whatever on them, because the new ones don't tend to run Tomato.
That's true.
Bless you.
Pardon me.
If you're sitting here, you would have heard 4 sneezes. 2 from her and 2 from Ventrilo.
Alright, cool.
I get to upgrade a device tomorrow that for some reason on the BookSense XT you have to perform the upgrade twice and then reformat the flash disk.
Fantastic.
I have no idea why. I tried to ask on the phone and she couldn't really explain it very well, so I don't know if she knew.
obviously if you disable the SSID broadcast, you're going to have to manually enter in the key on your devices. And also remember, simply turning off the SSID is not sufficient to get rid of any unauthorized access to your network. Instead of turning off the SSID, you can use stronger encryption such as WPA or WPA2. And we've got MAC address filtering. MAC address filtering is a technique used to deploy device-level security on a wireless LAN. Because every wireless client has a unique MAC address, wireless access points can prevent wireless clients from connecting to the wireless network if they do not have authorized MAC addresses. So basically what this is going to do is lock everything out that isn't authorized. It's vulnerable in attack.
Just a sort of a side note. Carrie, that program that you were talking about that emails you every time a new MAC address, I think it tries to get on your network. Well, that is that router dependent or not?
No.
Or, I mean, router specific?
No, but I think you need, I don't know whether there's a Windows port of it. It usually runs under a Linux, and it actually watches for ARP broadcasts. So it watches for the who has broadcasts, and it actually sends out the messages that way. So no, it's not router specific.
Because I was wondering if there was a way to find the MAC address of those. I mean, yes, every device has a unique MAC address, if you can find it. Otherwise, you don't know which ones to let in.
What actually happens in a lot of routers, just so that you know, is that it will actually give you a list of the MAC addresses it's seen, and then you can check boxes to say allow or deny those specific MAC addresses. If you are using an iThing, the MAC address is usually under about, I think. And most phones and stuff have a weird key combination to get the MAC address out of them. Like Nokias have this star hash thing that will actually dump the MAC address on screen. So there are ways to find out.
So, as I said, you want to layer this with other security techniques, make sure that you actually change your password and have some security enabled. To set up MAC address filtering on your Linksys, go to Wireless, Wireless MAC Filter, select and enable. Select prevent or permit for the access restriction type. Select the wireless client list. Select the client, save to MAC address filter list. Add save settings, continue. Add a MAC address for each client that you wish to permit or deny access to the wireless client list. So you can just deny certain MAC addresses. So if you want to, if you're annoyed at, you know, your little sister or brother or whatever, you can just set their iPod Touch not to connect and say, you have no idea why it isn't connecting.
The other thing to be aware of, though, is that every time you make these changes to the Linksys default firmware, it needs to reboot, and that is usually 45 seconds of annoyance. Every time you hit continue, the router actually reboots and everybody's kicked off for 45 seconds. So just keep that in mind.
Okay. The MAC address of a wireless NIC can be found by typing ipconfig/all at the command prompt. For devices other than computers, the MAC address can usually be found on the label of the device or within the manufacturer's instructions. Or there's probably a way to get it out of the device if you can't read either of those.
However, if you are blind, it's often printed on a barcode label. And if you have a barcode scanner or a copy of Digitize, you can scan the MAC addresses off that way as well.
if you've got a lot of people on the network, this MAC addressing can become quite a chore because you have to enter in everybody's MAC addresses before they can connect it to your network. It's not a real strong layer of security. Instead of using MAC address filtering, use stronger encryption techniques such as WPA or WPA2. Okay, firewalls. A firewall is a device or application installed on a network to protect it from unauthorized users and malicious attacks. You've got the software firewall, which we reviewed last week, which is installed on a computer to block specific incoming or outgoing traffic. For example, a firewall that is configured to block outgoing traffic on port 21 will not allow the computer to connect to a standard FTP server. The firewall can be configured to block multiple individual ports, a range of ports, or even traffic to and from specific applications. Your Linksys router is also a hardware firewall. A hardware firewall is isolates your network from other networks. This will pass two different types of traffic into your network. Traffic that originates from inside your network, and traffic destined for a port that you have intentionally left open. there are several types of hardware firewall configurations. There's packet filter. This configuration does not allow packets to pass through the firewall unless they match the established rules set configured in the firewall. Traffic can be filtered based on many attributes, such as source IP address, source port, or destination IP address or port. Also, you can do it by destination services such as www or FTP. We've got application layer. This configuration intercepts all packets traveling to or from an application. It prevents all unwanted outside traffic from reaching protected devices. And we've got a proxy. This configuration intercepts all traffic between computers and different networks and uses established rules to determine if data requests should be allowed. you can configure your hardware firewall settings on the Linksys by going to Security, Firewall, select Enable for SPI or Stateful Packet Inspection. Stateful Packet Inspection Firewall Protection. Then select other internal filters and web filters required to secure the network. There's a really neat lab in Discovery where you get to play with this and get to look through all of the stuff you can block out with your firewall. And it's actually really quite interesting. Of course, we click Save, Settings, Continue when we're done. Any questions on any of that? If you have a multifunction router, you might want to go in and have a look at your firewall if you haven't already. It's very interesting to see what it can actually do. All right, we have port forwarding and port triggering. Hardware firewalls are mainly used to block ports to prevent unauthorized access in and out of a LAN. However, you may actually want to have specific ports open so that certain programs will actually work. for example, if you don't have advanced plug-and-play enabled, Skype will work, but it won't work nearly as well. If you forward a Skype port through your firewall, you'll find that you log in a whole lot faster and there are less call dropouts. Port forwarding is a rule-based method of directing traffic between devices on separate networks. When your traffic reaches the router, your router determines if the traffic should be forwarded to a certain device based upon port numbers found with the traffic. For example, port numbers are associated with specific services, such as FTP, HTTP, HTTPS, and POP3. The rules determine which traffic will be sent on the LAN. For example, a router might be configured to forward port 80, which is associated with the HTTP protocol. If the router then receives a packet with the destination of port 80, the router will forward this traffic to a web server inside the network. To add port forwards on your Linksys, go to Applications and Gaming, Single Port Forwarding, and select or enter an application name. You may need to enter the external port number, internet port number, and protocol type. Then, enter the IP address of the computer that should receive the request. Click Enable, Save Settings, and Continue.
Any questions on port forwarding? When you're doing this, you know the order that the fields appear, because what will happen is it will show, like you'll see some headings that might say enable internal port, external port, address, name. You have to know what order they go in, because if you get the wrong information in the wrong boxes, it isn't going to go. And I sort of struggled a bit when I switched from Linksys to Tomato to try and figure out, now how did they reorder the port forwarding thing, and what order are the fields in now? Because they're not always labeled properly when you tab, so you'll have to probably learn what order they go.
All right. Now we've got port triggering. this allows the router to temporarily forward data through inbound ports to a specific device. You can use port triggering to forward data to a computer only when a designated port range is used to make an outbound request. For example, a video game might use ports 27000 to 27100 for connecting with other players. These are trigger ports. A chat client might use ports 56 for connecting the same player so that they can interact with each other. An example of a port triggering rule is when any gaming traffic uses an outbound port that is within the triggered port range, the inbound chat traffic on port 56 will be forwarded to the computer that is being used to play the video game and chat with friends.
How about I demystify that and say port triggering works by watching for some outgoing activity that says I'm playing a game, and then it will automatically open up the inbound ports to say here are the ports you need. Well, I think that's simpler anyway.
Yeah, that makes sense. I actually thought the other way was okay too.
Yeah, I kind of get it. So when the game's over, the triggered ports are no longer in use. They're going to shut down, so you're no longer going to receive any kind of chat information from port 56. So to do this, we go to Applications and Gaming, Port Range, Trigger, and type the application name. Enter the starting and ending ports, and the triggering port range. Starting and ending port numbers of the forwarded port range. Click Enable, Save, Settings, Continue. Now, if you guys don't understand any of this and don't like the way I'm reading the paths, that's okay, because you can go and look in the notes and they're all written out here for you. And you guys do get to do a configuring wireless security and configuring and testing on a wireless network. on a wireless router. So I'm hoping you all have wireless routers to play with. Any router will do. It doesn't matter if it's a Linksys. You'll just have to do some guesswork and really play around with that router until you find the equivalent setting on there.
Actually, my two-wire...
You should know how to do this anyway. This is stuff you really need to know.
What about your two-wire?
I was going to say, I really hope they don't make you update the firmware, because I can only connect to the router via wireless. Oh, good, because I don't have a soldering iron. But the two-wire that I have is actually really nice for port forwarding, because instead of making you enter the IP address, it actually lists it by computer name.
I know, I love
on
routers.
On the computers that you're connected. I don't like the two-wire for a lot of reasons, but, I mean, it's got the baby gates on, which is kind of nice in some ways.
Actually, yes, I'm quite into routers that allow me to do that as well.
That is nice.
allow you to put in name, do port forwards via computer names. That is fantastic, and I love it.
That certainly would simplify things.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Because generally your host name doesn't change as often as your IP does.
Absolutely, and I just feel like it's a way better way to do things. And Carrie says usually it's not because of the DNS implementation on the routers, but hey. You've got a lovely table about all the different permissions that you can use. Very nicely laid out here, but it's not quite a table yet. Don't worry, guys.
Read it
will
line
be
by line.
Yeah. It will be next term. We're going to try and have some people come in here and do some tabularizing. Oh, thank you. All right. Next, we are going to talk about firewall types. As we said, a firewall selectively defines traffic to a computer or network segment. These generally work by opening and closing ports used by various applications. By opening only the required ports on a firewall, you are implementing a restrictive security policy. That is important because it's in your test. If you open only the ports that are necessary, it is a restrictive security policy. Any packets not explicitly permitted is denied. In contrast, a permissive security policy permits access through all ports except those explicitly denied. Yeah. Because if we don't, it is just a pain to get everything through. In the past, software and hardware were shipped with permissive settings. As users neglected to configure their equipment, the default permissive settings left many devices exposed to attackers. Most devices now ship with settings as restrictive as possible while still allowing easy setup. So go into those firewalls and make sure that your programs are getting through. If a program doesn't work as expected and has to connect to the internet and won't authorize or something, it may be that your firewall is blocking it, so you should probably have a look. Software firewalls can be either independent applications or part of an operating system. There are several third-party software firewalls. Vipr was good, except it locked everybody's jaws out, which is so not cool. There's also software firewalls built into Windows XP. This is very accessible and kind of configurable, and it has gotten better in every Windows version. The Windows XP Service Pack 2 one wasn't fantastic, but the one in Windows 7 is pretty good. You can configure, this will actually help you in your lab, the Windows Vista and XP firewall in two ways. Automatically, you are prompted to keep blocking, unblock, or ask me later for any unsolicited requests. These requests may be from legitimate applications that have not been configured previously, or may be from virus or worms that has infected system. So you get to decide, and it will ask you. When you're installing a program or you think it's phoning home and you're just waiting on it, alt tab around your system and see if that message has come up to ask you whether to block it or not, because chances are it has if you've got the firewall on.
If an install hangs when you think it should be doing this, that's another thing. If an install is trying to activate and see should you be downloading using this product, or if it's one that you know goes out and downloads the what actually needs to be installed from the web, same thing, alt tab around.
You can also do a more manual configuration, going to manage security settings, where you can usually manually add the programs or ports that are required for the applications that you're going to use. Windows XP to add a program, select Start, Control Panel, Security Center, Windows Firewall, Exceptions, Add Program. To disable the firewall, which is one of the first things I do when I get a machine, is Start, Control Panel, Security Center, Windows Firewall. In Windows Vista to add a program, select Start, Control Panel, Security Center, Windows Firewall, Change Settings, Continue, Exceptions, and then Add Program. And to disable the firewall, select Start, Control Panel, Security Center, Windows Firewall, turn Windows Firewall on or off, continue, select off, not recommended, and OK. Because if you have a router that has a firewall on it already, you may not need this Windows Firewall.
Can't you go into Windows Firewall and skip the going through Security Center step? I don't really like...
Yes, you totally can.
The fact that they've... Because that just seems more convoluted.
Yep, you can. I do. The Windows Firewall blocks all incoming network connections except for specific programs and services. For example, the Windows Update Service and Internet Explorer are allowed through the firewall by default. Because they probably should be. An exception is a rule that opens a blocked port in the firewall for a specific need. For instance, to allow an FTP connection, you have to create an exception that will open up port 21. Each different type of connection requires a unique port number to pass data through the firewall. And we've got information on adding port exceptions to the Windows Firewall, which is in your text. Now, remember that every time you add an exception, you are poking a hole in your firewall. So adding too many exceptions is not a great idea if you want a really, really, really secure network. Any questions on firewalls? Is anyone awake?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you want to know if I'm awake, I'll send a keep alive. you were talking about Vipper being how it locked jaws. Maybe it should change its name to Tetanus.
No.
It's terrible.
All right. Be careful for that, because Vipper did decide that JAWS was a Trojan, and when you rebooted your computer, it unhappily got rid of JAWS for you and decided it was a Trojan, and it wasn't booting JAWS. Reloading JAWS. But that's why you have NVDA installed, right, guys?
Yeah.
Alright, malware is malicious software that's installed without your permission. Certain types of these attacks performed by spyware and phishing collect data about you that can be used to gain confidential information and steal your identity, credit cards, and bad things happen. So you should run antivirus programs and anti-spyware/malware programs. It may take several different...
How do phishing programs actually get your credit card information? Do they get the numbers as you type them? Do they search your computer for number strings?
They just sent you an email and say, hey, something terrible is going to happen. Go to this website, and then you simply enter in all this data so that this horrible thing, quote, doesn't happen, and there's your information stolen.
There are also
many of them appear to come from banks.
Yeah.
In fact, I had a I didn't have, but I remember a teacher of mine got one from a bank that she wasn't a member of, and actually took the initiative to call the bank, like, I think it was Fifth Third or something, and she's like, I'm not your customer, but I'm getting email that's claiming I am, and the password, and they said, well, forward it to this address so we can look at it.
And I always like to give out spoof at pay... Go ahead.
It's really funny when I get those from American banks. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
I don't have an account with Chase.
Absolutely. You might need multiple programs to protect you, but you only run one that does a virus scanner, because virus scanning programs can conflict.
So can the spyware ones.
Not as catastrophically.
I would say as a rule of thumb.
They do. Yeah, only have one program that does one particular type of active scanning at any one time. So don't have two spywares doing active scannings, don't have two virus scannings doing active scannings, don't have two anti-spammers doing different things at the same time, unless you know what you're doing.
Most of the spyware scans I know of don't do any... Most of the ones I use don't do any background scanning because they're free.
Spyware does. Spyware Doctor? Not Spyware Doctor, what's that spyware that everybody uses? The free one. Spybot. It's got that tea timer thing.
Oh, I always get rid of it.
Which we all turn off.
Yes. Okay, you all get a choice. I can go through preventative maintenance with you and all of that, or we can have a quiz, because we are done with the meat of this chapter. Pretty short one, huh?
We could do preventative maintenance.
Okay.
I really don't want to do the troubleshooting part.
Well, we won't do troubleshooting. We'll just do preventative maintenance. Okay. You want to make sure, basically, that you update your operating system, because it is often a target of malicious attacks, because it's your first point of contact, and people have all day to basically sit there and figure out ways to compromise the operating system. So we want to make sure that we have our automatic updates installed, being aware that if you are not genuine and you install certain genuine advantage patches, you will not have a genuine operating system anymore, and you won't be able to install updates.
However, Microsoft's policy is actually to allow all critical security updates to come down through automatic updates only if you are not genuine, because they got into trouble about blocking that. The government said that's not fair, you're exposing people to high profile risks, and even if they are pirates, they are endangering everyone else. So if you pull down all of your... Of course, we're all genuine here, so this doesn't apply to anyone here. But if you are non-genuine and you pull all updates down through automatic updates, even if you have it prompting you, because it will eventually trap you out as non-genuine, you are able to still receive all security updates, even if you flag as non-genuine.
But you can't get like the optional stuff, and sometimes those can
That's
be
right.
important.
Or Media Player 11 and stuff like that, because it tends to trip on genuine advantage as well. And there was a time when you couldn't get Internet Explorer 8 unless you were genuine, but they ended up lifting that.
Alright, I'm scrolling through diagrams here so I can look at more of this stuff for you guys. Alright, here we go. 16. There we go, found it. Cool. I love the find feature.
Yep.
Employees in an organization may require different levels of access to data. Your manager and an accountant may be the only employees in an organization with access to payroll files. Employees can be grouped by job requirements and given access to files according to group permissions. This helps manage employee access to the network. Temporary accounts can be set up for employees that need short-term access. For example, your consultants or whatever that might be working with you for a few weeks. close management of network access can help to limit areas of vulnerability that might allow a virus or malicious software to enter the network, or disgruntled employee to do horrible things to you. So when you fire somebody, the first thing you do while they're getting their stuff, if it's not computer related, is have the IT people close down their accounts. You don't wait, because if they're disgruntled, they can possibly do bad things for you. all right. You could also do guest accounts. Temporary employees and guests may need access to the network. For example, many visitors might require access to email and internet or printer on the network. These resources can be made available to a special account called guest. When guests are present, they can be assigned to the guest account. When no guests are present, the account can be disabled until the next guest arrives. Some guest accounts may require extensive access to resources, as in the case of a consultant, as I was talking about, or a financial auditor. This type of access should be granted only for the period of time required to complete the work that they're doing. So close it down when you're done, guys. Okay. And of course, we want to talk about backups. The best thing you can do in case there is a problem is make sure that you have backed up your
data. Yes.
Data.
Windows 7, guys, has a really good backup utility. Use it. Because not only does it take file-level backups, it also takes an image-level backup of your system partition, and if you actually bother to make the recovery rescue CD, DVD that nobody ever does, so go and do it after this lecture, like seriously, if you're running Windows 7, you just need a blank CD or DVD, you can actually restore your system from an image backup with Cited Help, I must say. But seriously, backup is one of those things that nobody does and everybody should, and I often, you know, everybody just waits until it's too late, or their internal hard drive fills up and then they put all of their music and stuff on the external hard drive, and because there's no room on the internal one anymore, and then when the external hard drive falls off the desk and bounces on the floor, they cry. Okay, so backup, really important. I'll let Grace get back to the actual prepared notes, but seriously, I'm not joking. It only takes a few moments for you to lose everything.
Okay, so make sure that you have offsite backups at a different location if you are an organization. do not backup your data on the same computer. You want separate physical backups. And they talk here a lot about how to use the XP backup system. So if you want to check that out, that is
you had a lab
pretty
on.
Cool. Yeah. I believe they do.
Yeah, it would have been earlier in the course, but yeah, there was a lab, because I remember playing with the system state stuff, so yeah, there's a lab.
This is different than backing up system states. This is backing up the whole thing.
But I'm saying you will have at least seen the utility a little bit.
Yes, absolutely.
The other utility that rocks your socks is a thing called image.dos/windows/linux, and it is about $30, I think, for a single user license, and you get all three versions, and if you boot the Linux version up, you can SSH into it and control it, and when you do that, you can then back up your entire Windows partition and restore it without Cite. So, good bit of kit. It's made by Terabyte Unlimited.
Great name for a company, if any.
Yeah!
Absolutely.
Okay, this is something that I've wanted to go over forever and seriously have not found in the text, so it's a good thing we're doing this. There are five different types of backups. Full or normal backup, this is exactly what it sounds like. It copies all of the selected files and marks each file as having been backed up. We've got an incremental backup. This type of backup backs up only files that have been created or changed since the last full or incremental backup. Restoring files requires that you have at least have the last full backup set and all incremental backup sets. Then we've got the differential backup. This backup type copies only files that have been created or changed since the last full backup. Restoring files requires that you have the last full backup and one differential backup. It also allows you to do a daily backup. This backup copies all selected files that have been modified the day that the daily backup has been performed. And copy. This type of backup copies all selected files but does not mark them as having been backed up. Any questions on those different backup types, or does everybody kind of understand the differences?
I imagine if you were charged with the responsibility of backing up an organization's data and you didn't quite understand it well, you'd have to really understand it really quickly.
Well, you could go to the internet and look it up.
Yeah. I think that's something you would, if you really don't understand, you'd have to actually get some practical experience.
No, if you don't understand it, it's a pretty simple concept, and we can go over it again, because it is something that you kind of want to understand.
I think
my roommate just bought an external drive with a button on it that is one of those one-touch backup drives, and it's really cool because not only does it back up his whole computer, he can set it to how many copies of the files that it keeps. 5 is the default, but he set it to 2. But it will also, I believe automatically when it's plugged in, change each file on the drive as it's changed on his computer. So I'm assuming that would be a differential backup. Yeah, it is. I'm really impressed. I gotta find out what type.
Yeah,
of drive
I think
he
that
has.
Would be. that
I'm
should be a differential
that whatever
backup.
Software it uses is accessible. That's my only concern.
Yeah, the restore might not be
how
too
easy
cool.
Is it going to be? Yeah, it's great to hear.
Well,
a
he's cited,
back
so
up,
it doesn't matter. But
yeah,
I
the other
about
thing
restore,
is
that's true.
The other thing is apparently there's some statistics that say 80% of external drives fail within the first 6 months of ownership. So my suggestion would be don't back up everything onto one-touch backup drive. Maybe you want two.
Two friends and I bought an external drive, the same type. It was on sale, Feature Shop. I think all of ours failed after about 6 months to a year. But what people don't realize a lot of the times is it's not the drive that fails, it's the case. I got my friend to take the 500 gig drive out of the case that ended up dead, and the 500 gig drive is still going strong in the computer today, and that was 2 years ago.
Absolutely.
So I'm thinking that unless the drive is dropped, it's mostly the cases that fail, not the drives.
Usually it is. The other thing you've also got to watch out for is if you happen to buy those WD Passport drives and stuff, the actual USB bridge circuitry is actually soldered onto the circuit board, so you can't take the drive out. So watch out for those itty-bitty pocket drives. Sometimes they save space by removing some of the circuitry, so you can't take them apart. Well, you can, but then you can't actually put it into anything else because all of it's soldered together.
Okay. There we go. We're down to troubleshooting. So
yeah,
that is our final lecture. And module 16 is up, actually, on the website if you want to read it.
The 16.5.2 that has the common security problems and solutions is quite good, actually. Rather long, but that's pretty good. You might want to take a look at that. And honestly, I was talking with my friend that's helping me do these diagram descriptions, and I said to him, I wish students had to see this as many times as you and I have been looking at it, because
yeah.
It's in every single chapter, and he's got to go through and make sure that it's that it's formatted correctly, and that every single chapter.
Oh, yeah.
We will never forget it, even though we might want to. So
the very fortunate thing for you guys.
You have it burned into your skull.
Oh, yeah. The very fortunate thing for you guys is that the troubleshooting process is not as big a feature in the quizzes or anything, believe it or not, as last year.
In
beat it
4.0,
to death.
Well, they still beat it to death, but you had to had to be able to put them in the right order. And
oh, yeah.
They would give you a scenario and say, which step of the process is it?
For people who aren't on Twitter, and that might be one or two of us, don't upgrade to 4.3 beta on your iThing because Skype doesn't work, and that will probably make you cry.
Ow.
Especially because unless you've saved your SSHS blobs, you cannot downgrade.
Oh, I bet that made even more people cry.
All right, guys, let's quiz. Do the last quiz of the year. Everybody wake up. All right.
Morning
don't
has
worry,
broken.
My headset. Don't worry, my headset died, and now it keeps going beep, 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 so I'm definitely awake.
For the rest of you that do not have dying headsets, wake up. It's quiz time.
Yeah.
Let's get this done.
Please wait several moments while Grace rifles through the flash. Your patience is appreciated.
That's a lot more sincere than some of the whole things I've been hearing lately. Some of them
your
just
call is
so
important
insane.
To us.
No,
really.
Your study is important to us, and we will make every opportunity to ensure that your study progress is as successful as possible. Sorry, I just ran out of words.
All right, cool. Here we are. Everybody in their chat windows? Let's make sure I am. And here we go. Which practice is a minimum requirement for securing a network? Deploy a firewall. Create secure login information for all users. Encrypt all data. Log all activity on the network. Choose now. Anyone else?
I think I would have gone B.
I would go A. You've got to have the firewall.
Firewall.
It's not the network. It's not the computers. It's the network.
Okay. I'll disagree with.
Okay. A technician notes that the corporate security policy is referred to as a restrictive security policy. Which definition describes a restrictive security policy? Any traffic not specifically denied is permitted. Any traffic not specifically permitted is denied. Traffic is permitted only after it successfully passes all configured security measures, or only traffic entering the network through specific ports is permitted. Choose now. For those of you who picked B, good job. Any traffic that is not specifically permitted is denied. That is restrictive. Which tool is used to manage the backup and restoration of files on a Windows Vista computer? Administrative Tools, Backup and Restore Center, Device Manager, Security Center. Choose now. Yep, this is a pretty obvious one. It's going to be the Backup and Restore Center. Okay. Which Windows Vista error message will be displayed as a result of virus damage to the master boot record? And this is kind of a critical thinking thing. A, bad commander file name, error loading operating system, MBR has been changed or modified, caution, this hard disk may be infected by viruses. I think, I'm not sure if it would be B or C.
What's B? B is unable to load operating
system. Error loading, yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
That's what I think it would be.
I think one of them actually does.
MBR has been changed or modified. I don't think it would tell you that.
I think one of them it actually does say caution. This might be infected by a virus. I think it's in one of those.
They won't say it that at that point. Oh, you're that's something that might come up on a website.
No,
I think because it's okay. It is
that
in
only
one
comes
of
up
those places.
That only comes up after you booted though, Sean. This one comes up at boot time. But you're right, that message does come up if the master boot record has been changed. But actually, that's a BIOS error message, that one. The BIOS usually warns you if the master boot record's been changed if you've got virus protection in the BIOS turned on, which is always not a very good idea.
That one might be where we consult 16.5.2, because I know that's in there.
Is it? Okay. I can actually have a look, if anyone cares. I'll have a look quickly.
Because there's two very similar ones in there.
Okay, let's see.
Actually, we should have finished the quiz off and then come back so that we could actually...
Okay. Yeah, we can...
That way, if anybody doesn't want to stick around, they don't have to. So if you really don't care what the answer
is... Yeah, basically. Can... Okay.
Yeah.
Why should the default username and password be changed as soon as an access point is powered on and accessed? The change provides a minimum level of security to the access point. The change reduces the chance of the wireless network being detected. It decreases the chance of interference from nearby wireless devices. It secures the wireless device by requiring all devices that access the wireless network to provide the network username and password. Choose now. No one have any ideas of what one that would be? It would actually be A. When you change the username and password of the access point, it's going to give you a minimum level of security. That means that someone who is outside of your network is not easily going to be able to hack in and change your wireless settings.
Yeah, because it's not going to be admin anymore.
Which firewall option provides a way to limit traffic based on a specific protocol for an indefinite period of time? Port separation, port forwarding, protocol triggering, protocol separation. And I'm guessing that would be protocol separation, which I don't actually remember seeing. So, odd. Because port forwarding will allow.
Yeah, that's one I've never heard of either.
Sorry, I was fixing an async, so I wasn't paying any attention.
Port separation will block certain ports for an indefinite amount of time, correct?
What are your options? Port separation...
Port forwarding, port triggering, protocol triggering, or protocol separation?
To be honest, I don't know.
So we throw
it's
the
not
question.
Your final.
No, you're not going to see
seriously,
that again.
Seriously, read the book. Who cares?
It sounds like a Cisco thing. Really?
No, it probably is an actual term, but unless you're actually immersing yourself in
I've
the
never
firewall
saw
configuration,
that.
You wouldn't know.
I didn't see that in the chapter anywhere.
What is a feature of the firewall capability when Windows Vista is the operating system? The firewall is disabled by default. The firewall can be modified using the network control panel. The firewall can be managed manually by permitting or allowing specific ports. The firewall blocks Windows Vista and Internet Explorer updates by default. Choose now. And for those who said C, you're right, you can manually configure the Windows Vista firewall. And that's not to say you can't do that with XP, it just they just decide to ask about Vista, because you can do it with both.
Vista's pretty cool because a lot of the common exceptions are already like in the list, and you can just check the ones you want. Like, they've already got FTP and connect to a network projector and all kinds of stuff in there already, and you just... I don't know if XP has it quite that easy to deal with the exceptions.
Okay.
It's pretty cool.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So somebody really screwed up their firewall here, and now nobody can access any web pages. So this is not a multiple choice question because you guys should know this. Which port would we need to open to fix this problem and allow people to browse the internet again? And 80 would be right. Good job. And that web administrator or network administrator should be chastised for that. What three options can be applied to a file that is infected by a computer virus? Choose three. Backup, delete. This should probably be a yes
hang
or
on,
no. So backup. Would that be a yes or no? That's a no. You probably don't want to back up that file. How about delete? Yes, absolutely, you can delete it. How about quarantine? Yes, you might want to quarantine it in case it is something important. Rename? That would be a no. Restore? No, restore wouldn't be right. But how about repair? Yes, and if you click repair, it's going to attempt to repair it. It might not always work, but your antivirus will give it a go and try to clean up what it thinks is wrong with that file.
And boy, it's a relief when it does. When that does work.
Alright, what can a homeowner that has a wireless signal, router do to hide the wireless router signal from the neighbors? A. Enable web filtering. Disable WAP monitoring is B. Disable SSID broadcast is C. Or disable MAC filtering. Choose now. Ah, you guys were paying attention. The answer is C. A substitute teacher for a computer class is trying to log in using the guest account, but cannot log into the domain. What action can the network administrator do to allow the substitute teacher to log in? Is it A, enable the guest account? B, restart the computer and try the password again? Have you turned it off and on again? C, change the administrator login to the guest login? Or D, enable UAC on the computer? He's absolutely right.
And if they do C, they should be fired immediately.
Basically. I don't think you can even do that.
Oh, yes, you can.
Really?
Oh, yes, you can make the guest guest account have administrator privilege.
Oh.
Actually, the other thing that everybody should do, and nobody does it, and in fact, I have to give myself a smack after after lecture and go and do it, is rename your administrator account.
I'm not even sure I know how to do that. I definitely need to do it in my virtual machine. Because it's definitely just administrator.
Well, no offense, but and I'm going to do exactly the same thing, but guess what? There's an article in the Microsoft Knowledge Base that tells you exactly how to do it. So I'm sure if you go rename administrator account into Google, it will give us all that knowledge base account, and we'll go look up how to do it. That's what I'd be doing. Don't ever underrate that knowledge base of Microsoft, guys. It is absolute solid gold. It's one of the things that Microsoft has actually done properly, and there is probably an answer to just about any of your Windows-related questions in that knowledge base. So if you haven't ever looked at it, go and have a gander, because that's how I work stuff out. Sure, in fact, I've been known to cut and paste error messages into the search field so that it then tells me how to fix them.
Yeah, that
after logging in... Sorry. After logging into a computer, a user is unable to access the CIW folder. Access to this folder is necessary to complete an assignment. Which two access can the administrator take to provide the user access to the folder and make the user very sad because now they have to do said assignment? Choose two. A. Give the person rights to the CIW folder. That's right. Yes, you can do that. Allow the user to authenticate into a guest account. No, probably not, because honestly, the guest account would probably not have access either. Can they add the user to a group that has the rights to the CIW folder? And the other two options are just plain silly, so we won't even go there. And you guys are
that,
right.
That group might be a good way to do it if they were all in the same class, let's say.
What can a technician do to make sure that no one changes the BIOS settings on a computer? Put a lock on the outer case of the computer? Put strong passwords on the administrator account? Set the BIOS password on the motherboard? Install a specialized keyboard that does not have the key that unlocks the BIOS? Choose now.
I think everybody was so not paying attention that they can't remember that the correct answer is option C.
It's going to be C. Set the BIOS password on the motherboard. As long as no one picked D, we're good.
I really, really, really think that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
Not really, because you can just pull the battery and get it back anyway, Sean.
Oh, hang on, I'm thinking of the wrong one. Okay. Is this one that just says, hey, you can't go hit delete and get into the BIOS, and if you do it, it gives you a password?
Basically.
No, it does both. It does both. There's two of them. You can either set it to only restrict access to the BIOS, or you can actually make it prompt for the password on every boot up.
That's the one I don't think is such a good idea.
Well, for some people it is a good idea. I mean, how hard is it to type grommet every time you turn the computer on? And it will stop people from using your computer. And we don't recommend you use grommet as your BIOS password, obviously, but just as an example.
Okay, that is it for this module quiz. Thank you for joining us, everybody. I am working on grading all of your labs that have come in at the last minute, so we're working on that, so watch for emails. And for those of you who are not joining us again next year, it's been really fun. You're always welcome to come back to any lectures if you ever want to, and the mailing lists are still open to you. And for those people who are coming back next year,
accounts are still open.
Oh, absolutely. As I said, you can always come on to lectures.
But we don't want to go deleting all 150 plus of those, go back through trying to delete students, because it is not pretty.
If you do find that your Ventrilo account doesn't work years down the track and you want it back, just message us, because either we're gone or someone went in and actually did do a massive clean out of people who had not been on the server for a long time, because that did happen once.
We actually rechanged all of the Ventrilo accounts so they were first name dot last name. Which is why we end up clearing it all out and putting it all back. But we won't delete your account unless you do something that annoys us or are disruptive in lecture. And that's nobody here, so.
Yeah. I don't know if I would say that probably hasn't happened terribly often.
It happened once. And that person was actually just muted. They weren't actually deleted, they were muted. So, yeah. It's not something that we do very often.
For those people returning to ITE 1, if you are studying with me, we will be doing the courses starting the first week of February in this time slot, one lecture per week again, and we will see you there. If you're studying with Kylie, then you meet on a Monday night, American time. If you're not sure who you're studying with, get a hold of me and we will figure that out.